According to the National Institute of Mental Health, over 17 million American adults have suffered an episode of major depression. For many years, drugs and psychotherapy have been the go-to treatments for depression, but drugs sometimes don't work or stop working. Many people suffering from chronic depression have switched antidepressant medications multiple times, and some clinical studies have challenged the effectiveness of pharmaceuticals altogether. Our guest this morning proposes mindfulness based on thousand-year-old Buddhist practices as a promising method of treating depression. Dr. Stuart Eisendrath is a senior clinician and research psychiatrist at the University of California in San Francisco. He's also the founder of the UCSF Depression Center. Dr. Eisendrath's methods are outlined in a new book titled When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, subtitled Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. He joins us this morning from San Francisco. Good morning, Dr. Eisendrath.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, again, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, most people who are currently receiving treatment for depression get a combination of drugs and psychotherapy. Is there a typical approach for treating depression now?
Well, the most common approach for treating depression actually is no treatment, in the sense that people often go undiagnosed and untreated. After that, that's due to the fact that people may have experienced stigma about coming forward, or that they don't recognize that they are depressed, that they accept the negative conditions that they're in as being actual facts and don't seek depression. Then for the people who do seek treatment, the most common treatment actually are antidepressants. Primary care physicians are the primary people prescribing antidepressants, and it's sort of their go-to approach because of the limitations of time and their treatment abilities.
Is that a flaw in our system that primary care physicians, who may not have specialized training in psychiatry, are prescribing these medications?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a flaw in the sense that it's important to try to treat people when they can recognize depression. It's just that they don't have, in some cases, the expertise to be able to manage depression over the long haul. But it's good that they are able to, they come in contact with most people, so it's good that they have an awareness of depression and can start a preliminary treatment.
I just open up a little bit about my own life here. I'm quite familiar with the effects of depression because my father, who passed away in 2002, battled depression his entire life. And so I saw it up close. And I remember as a child, I think I was maybe just in my teenage years, perhaps, sitting in a psychiatrist's office, learning about what was going on with my father and being told that, this is a chemical imbalance in the brain and these drugs are going to fix that. And, it didn't work for him for the rest of his life. So I'm wondering about that metaphor, that understanding of depression. Is it indeed caused by brain abnormalities or chemical imbalances?
Well, to some extent, that's true, that there are brain abnormalities, and they were a little more sophisticated than the chemical imbalance theory. What we see in depression is there are actual areas of the brain that don't that function on an abnormal basis in depression, and you can actually make changes in that functioning through a variety of means. For example, in our studies of people with depression, we found that the emotion production areas producing anxiety and depression were elevated, whereas the emotion regulation areas of the brain were decreased. And by teaching people mindfulness techniques, we were able to reverse that and bring the brain back to essentially a normal pattern of functioning where the emotion regulation areas of the brain were increased. So mindfulness meditation is actually a powerful to bring the brain back to normal functioning. It isn't just smoke and mirrors. It's actually changing the way the brain functions.
We're talking with Dr. Stuart Eisendrath. He's the founder of the UCSF Depression Center at the University of California, San Francisco, and the author of a new book called When Antidepressants Aren't Enough. The subtitle of the book is Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. You can join the conversation here on The Exchange by calling us at 800-838-3760 by phone, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Eisendrath, you mentioned earlier that the most common treatment in the United States is no treatment at all because people are either not in a position to receive treatment or a diagnosis, or they're maybe not even aware that they're depressed. But is our country more apt to prescribe drugs as the first course of treatment than other countries? I mean, I've heard from people, you know, who live in Europe that they're more often to prescribe, you know, a removal from daily life for a period of time, relaxation, more exercise, changes in diet.
There's some tendency for the European countries to offer psychotherapy as a first-line treatment. So although they use drugs, antidepressants, quite a bit, there may be more tendency, partly because it's that form of treatment is better covered by insurance in those countries. So they may add psychotherapy to the package initially.
And so, but we are still, because we're relying a lot of the time on primary care physicians who are pressed for time, perhaps drugs are the first course in the United States? Or is that a misapprehension?
No, that's absolutely true. Drugs are the first choice. I mean, primary care physicians are under pressure of time, and it's much easier to prescribe an antidepressant than to do anything else in the primary care office visit.
You know, one aspect of depression you focus on earlier in the book is something you call rumination. How does that work in a depressed person?
Well, rumination is one of the primary drivers of depression. And rumination is basically when the person is locked into a loop of thinking about past events, usually past losses that they've experienced or that they think they've experienced, maybe a loss of a job, loss of prestige, loss of a loved one, loss of money, some type of loss that the person has experienced, and they keep ruminating about how that might have been different. And this differs from problem solving, because problem solving leads to action, whereas rumination doesn't lead to action, just leads to an endless loop, and the person becomes more depressed afterwards. So mindfulness is a way of breaking that cycle of rumination and changing one's relationship to the ruminative thought pattern.
So when we talk about mindfulness, can you describe it and then how you came to embrace it as a treatment?
Well, mindfulness is being aware of your experience as you are experiencing it. So you're focusing on whatever is happening in your life. In a meditation, it might be focusing on something like your body sensations or your breath. In everyday life, it may be paying attention to whatever it is you're doing. So noticing the sensations in your feet and legs as you're walking. And I became familiar with mindfulness because I myself have experienced depression, and I learned about mindfulness about 25 years ago when I found that it was a very useful thing for decreasing stress. And stress, of course, is a precipitant for depression. And I found that mindfulness was a very valuable technique for breaking up that stress-depression cycle.
So can you tell people how this differs from another very popular treatment form, of cognitive behavior therapy?
Yes. In cognitive behavior therapy, the person tries to answer back to negative thoughts. In mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is really a blend of meditation from Buddhist techniques of going back as far as 2,500 years ago with some cognitive therapy aspects. In mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, well, let me start with cognitive behavior therapy. In that approach, the person tries to answer back to negative thoughts and come up with an alternative thought. The trouble with that approach is if you've been depressed for a long time, and the people in our study had been suffering a depressive episode for 7 years, that if you've been depressed for a long time, you tend to believe negative thoughts and have a hard time coming up with an alternative. In our approach, you don't try to come up with an alternative thought. You learn to change your relationship to that thought. It's kind of like if you're walking down a street that has many storefronts on it, and each storefront has a negative thought. In depression, you have a tendency to go in and buy that thought and take it on as if it's an actual fact. In our approach, you keep walking down the street when you notice the depression, the depressive thoughts, so you don't go in the store and buy it. The negative thoughts are still there. They don't go away, but you don't have to buy them and believe them as a fact. So we differentiate between what is a thought and what is a fact. And in depression, there's often a mistake made that a thought is a fact, whereas in our technique, we learn that it is just a thought, just a mental event, and you don't have to be sucked in by it.
Yeah, to me, as I was reading your book, that was a very powerful insight that, oh, yeah, this negative thought I'm having is a negative thought. It's coming from me. It doesn't mean that that is a, you know, cold, hard fact in the real world.
Exactly. In depression, because it is so widespread, we now know that there are basically 30 top negative thoughts in depression. And any one person has a certain set of thoughts that apply to them, sort of like their own personal Letterman top 10 negative thoughts. And once you recognize this and that those thoughts are just thoughts, and then, in fact, other people share them, you start to change your relationship to those thoughts as not necessarily being true, but actually just being negative thoughts and not facts. And that's important for the person. And once they realize that, it has an antidepressant effect of its own.
So in your treatment, you mentioned in your book, you talk about the creation of the observing self. Tell us how that works.
Well, the observing self is noticing what you're doing or what you're thinking. So you can say, there I am thinking about negative thoughts. I can observe myself thinking my thoughts. Instead of being pulled into just believing the thought, I can notice myself producing that thought. It's like our minds are popcorn poppers. And unfortunately, in depression, you tend to believe those thoughts. And if you do believe those thoughts, like a thought like, I'll never be successful, or I'm not as good as other people, or I'm always going to be a failure, or I'm no good as a person. If you believe those thoughts, it naturally cycles into being more depressed. And if you're more depressed, you generate more negative thoughts. Mindfulness is a way to break up that cycle. And instead of having a negative thought and believing it, you can start to see it as just a thought.
Dr. Stuart Eisendrath is our guest this morning. He's the founder of the University of California, San Francisco Depression Center and the author of a new book, When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. You can join the conversation this morning by calling us at 800-838-3760 by phone, or you can send us a question via email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So when you're treating somebody who's depressed and you're helping them create this observing self, how do you do that?
Well, you do that with a series of exercises that builds up that observing capacity. For example, if you're doing a meditation, which may be quite short, actually, even a few minutes of focusing on the breath, for example, and in the book, there's a series of meditations, and on my website, there's free audio files that can be downloaded or streamed. So, for example, if you're focusing on your breath, you notice your mind wanders to, say, a negative thought, and whatever it might be, like I'm not a good person. And then you notice the thought, and then you bring your attention back to the breath. Then your mind wanders again, and then you bring your attention gently and kindly back to the breath. And as you do this, you begin to notice that there may be a pattern to those thoughts that your mind wanders to, and you start to observe them as just thoughts. They may be even like, what am I going to have for dinner tonight? Or, I should have said this to this person. Or, there I am again. I'm thinking a negative thought. And so they start to notice when they're having a negative thought that it is just a negative thought. And they can bring their attention back to the breath and say to themselves, I've just gone through a cycle of negative thoughts. So they start to be able to observe themselves generating negative thoughts, and this puts them in the position of responding differently to those thoughts rather than just reacting to them.
And again, responding to them as thoughts and not facts.
Exactly. When they can recognize that, they're really in a position to make changes in their life.
So have you ever had a situation where you've helped a patient create this observing self, and they're kind of on the road, they're practicing meditations and mindfulness and observing their thoughts, and then the observing self itself becomes depressed? I mean, can this be sort of like a set of nesting Russian dolls where then you have to intervene in some other fashion?
Well, not so much. We don't really find the observing self. The observing self is kind of like, it's said in different ways, but it's sort of like the umpire in a game. It's really above the outcome of the game. It's observing it. It's kind of like you can think of it as looking down. In fact, another analogy that may shed some light on it is if you're on a bridge over a train track and the train goes by, you may notice the train is filled with negative thoughts, but you don't jump on the train. You just observe them coming into consciousness and then fading away with your observing self. But the observing self doesn't really get depressed. It just observes and notices what's going on and notices the thoughts come up and then fade off into the distance.
So, how does a person, actually construct themselves that observing self? Is it only through meditation, or are there other methods, metaphorical methods or something, to allow somebody to come to that point where they recognize that observing self?
Well, there are different techniques of recognizing that that you can observe your thoughts. I mean, one brief meditation is just thinking of yourself as having the thoughts. So observing your thought generation just for a few moments, a few minutes. And you could say to yourself, as you observe, there's Stuart having a thought, and then waiting and noticing another thought pop up. Or another metaphor that could be used is you're like a well-fed cat that isn't really hungry anymore, and you can observe a mouse hole. And then as you notice, the mouse comes out, and you can notice it scampering away. And those mice are really like your thoughts. They come into focus, and then they scamper away. You don't have to really engage with them. You can just observe them.
We're talking depression this morning with Dr. Stuart Eisendrath, who's the author of a book called When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. I would imagine that this varies from person to person, but for this particular treatment to be effective, how frequently would somebody need to practice mindfulness and meditate?
Well, we recommend that a person forms a regular practice, and it may be brief. It may be a few times, it may be on a daily basis, or it may even be as they're doing things in their daily life. There hasn't been a study that has clearly established a minimum amount of time. One study suggested that as brief as 10 minutes a day can be effective. And other studies haven't even found that if a person is being dispositionally mindful, being that is being mindful throughout their day, that can be important. What's important about mindfulness is really this: you're focusing on your present moment, and depression is focused on the past, experiencing as if you've experienced a loss. Anxiety is focused on the future, as if you're expecting a catastrophe. If you focus on the present moment, you're occupying your mind's bandwidth, so you don't focus on the past or the future. The focus on the present moment is naturally antidepressant.
Yeah, I want to talk, you mentioned anxiety and anger. I want to get into that in our next segment because those are fascinating aspects of this whole process. But before we go to the break, there's a chapter in your book which is titled, Your Mind is Not Always Your Friend. And I think most of us would consider that inner voice that we have to be our own true self. You know, that's the inner voice that kind of regulates our daily behavior, et cetera. And we therefore trust it most of the time. But you say it doesn't always work that way.
That's correct. In depression particularly, it doesn't work that way.
And so the depressed person is hearing what from that inner voice?
They're hearing a series of negative thoughts, usually. I mean, one woman, for example, in our group realized, and this was a big change for her, that she was having negative thoughts, particularly negative thoughts about her body, that she was too fat, when from an observer's viewpoint, she really wasn't. But her thought was, she's too fat. And she bombarded herself with these thoughts. As she put it, I was having a negative public relations program against myself 1,000 times a day. So it was really a powerful series of thoughts. And if you believe those thoughts, you really are more depressed. So depression can be worsened by getting depressed about being depressed.
And that is sort of a spiral then.
Exactly. There's a spiral, and what mindfulness is so helpful with is breaking that spiral. So instead of having a downward spiral where you get more depressed about having depression, you may experience the pain of depression, but you let go of the factors driving that depression even lower.
There are a lot of interesting anecdotes in your book about, you know, the stories that people tell themselves. I found this amusing, but, you know, obviously it's also troubling, where you were doing some sort of a gathering and you had a potluck and you were doing a meditation, and one of the people in the meditation was smelling some cheese from the potluck, but assumed that her feet smelled.
Yes, before she recognized it was coming from cheese. She thought it was her, and she thought people weren't going to like her because of that. So that's what the person with depression often does, is they have a negative thought, and they blame themselves. And that's one of the reasons why they don't seek treatment in the first place. They blame themselves and don't think anything can change. They feel helpless, and they feel hopeless. And so as long as they feel that way, they're kind of stuck in that depressive state.
So one of the things I was really fascinated by in your book was your description of how depression changes one's relationship to time. Can you share that with us?
Well, I look at depression and anxiety as really being disorders of time, where the person is focused really on the past in the case of depression, or on the future in the case of anxiety. And if you focus on the present moment, you really break up that disorder. So the person stays focused on the present moment and lets go of the focused on the past, which is really another way of saying it. They let go of those ruminations about the past. So by focusing on the present moment, they're in a much better position to be able to do something and respond to those situations rather than to just merely react to them.
And is it also the case that somebody who's profoundly depressed, you know, is not really aware, because they are ruminating, they're not really aware of the passage of real time, external time? They're just so far down that they're just, like, stuck?
That's right. They're often stuck for in a ruminative pattern, and they don't even recognize they're ruminating. That's one of the things mindfulness does, is help them recognize, ah, there I am ruminating again.
You mentioned anxiety as sort of depression focused on the future. You know, it's pretty obvious that we live in a time where there's a great deal of anxiety in the world. And I'm wondering, is it possible that this mass anxiety that seems to be everywhere can actually lead to depression? I mean, can depression actually become contagious?
Well, it can be a factor, definitely. I mean, there's all kinds of things happening in our world which can be stressful for the individual. And, for example, climate anxiety can make people very anxious, and that can lead to depression, because I've seen even young 10-year-old children, you know, witnessing the events in the climate change and getting depressed and upset about it. So stressors like that, or like other things in our everyday life, can lead to anxiety and then lead to depression. So it's quite possible. Usually there's a mixture of anxiety and depression. And so that in 75% of the people we studied who had a depressive disorder, 75% of them had an anxiety disorder as well. So those disorders of time, the past or the future, work together, really, and are usually entwined.
So, and you also mentioned that anger is another bedfellow of depression. How does that weave together with anxiety?
Well, anger is really, I would say, woven often in with depression. In fact, sometimes we like to ask a person, or think of, if we're trying to understand a person's depression, who are they depressed at? There's often somebody or something that the person is depressed at, some situation where they feel helpless, where they feel they're submitting to someone or something, where they feel they're being cut off and have no choice. So that anger about a situation and taking it personally is often part of the situation, where they get upset, angry, and then depressed or anxious. For example, one woman often felt anxious about her children going out, like, for example, on a date at night, and thought something terrible would happen, a car accident and so on, and would be just terrified while she was home waiting for them to come home. And this led to a great deal of anxiety. She might even be angry if her son was home late from a date. And she came in wanting to get rid of all anxious thoughts. And what she learned is it's really impossible to get rid of the thoughts, but it is possible to change your relationship. She started to become able to say, ah, there I'm having another anxious thought again, and labeling it as an anxious thought rather than believing it. So there I am having a thought of a catastrophe, but I don't have to buy that thought.
So can you walk us through the process by which somebody who is suffering from depression comes into mindfulness? So do you focus on people who have tried antidepressants and they've failed, or they're not working as well anymore, and then bring them into mindfulness? Or are you proposing mindfulness as a first and an initial therapy for somebody who's depressed?
Well, it varies. Mindfulness was first developed as a relapse prevention strategy, so people who had fully recovered from depression, and then it was discovered through various studies that it was effective in preventing relapse compared to treatment as usual. And in a major study, it was with a large number of participants, it was just as good, slightly better, in fact, just as good or better at preventing relapse in people who were continued on maintenance antidepressant treatment compared to people who were taught mindfulness. and then tapered off their antidepressants. So mindfulness is a powerful technique that can be used as a treatment to prevent relapse. It can be used as a treatment, as we did in our study, to treat residual depression after a person has tried antidepressants and maybe responded partially to them or not at all. And there's some evidence that it can be used as a first-line treatment. We actually did a small study showing that it was just as effective as antidepressants as a first-line theory, as first-line approach. But that needs to be carried out in a much larger randomized controlled trial. So that is the sort of the least evidence for that treatment approach that phase.
I want to bring in a question here that was emailed from a listener named Susan, and I actually could have written this myself. She says, how does one stop ruminations when awakened in the middle of the night?
Well, that's a good question. Ruminations, first of all, this gets at that observing self. If you're ruminating, most people don't even know they're ruminating. They're stuck in the rumination. So if you start to step out of that pattern and say, oh, there I am ruminating again, you have a choice of whether or not you're going to stay with the rumination or you're going to bring your attention elsewhere. And you can, for example, break up the ruminative pattern by focusing on a brief meditation. And there's a variety of them in the book that allow for breaking up that rumination. For example, focusing on counting your breath is one of the simple ones. Count your breath starting from zero and each in-breath up to 10. After you get to 10, if you get to 10, and many people don't get to 10 because our minds wander so much, if you can keep counting up until your mind wanders, if the mind wanders to a certain thought or to a rumination, you just go back down to zero and start again. So it's a way of responding to the rumination rather than being stuck by it.
Our guest is Dr. Stuart Eisendrath. He is the founder of the University of California San Francisco Depression Center, and we're talking about his new book called When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. You can join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I have a question here that was phoned in by a listener, but didn't want to be on the air. And this listener says, what is the relationship between mindfulness and denial? And the example that she uses is, if you feel like you drink too much, is it mindful to acknowledge that? Or can you then find yourself in denial by saying, I'm not actually drinking that much?
Well, that's a good question, because the first step in being able to deal with a problem is to acknowledge it and to accept it. For example, if the person denies that they have a drinking problem, they're not going to be able to do anything about it because they're denying it. Whereas in mindfulness, you accept whatever is happening as it is without judgment or criticism. So if you say, okay, I have a drinking problem, then you're in a position to do something about it, like I'm going to get treatment, or I'm going to join AA, or I'm going to do something else. I'm going to take Anabuse to help curb my drinking, or one of the other medicines that has been used to help control drinking. But that requires acceptance and acknowledgement. Once you do that, you can respond skillfully to the situation, whereas if you're in denial, you're kind of continuing to be stuck with that problem.
So, Dr. Eisendrath, we have a regular segment on our show in which we just listen to the stories of people who are experiencing mental illness. And these stories often, these people telling the stories often have pretty complex multiple diagnoses, which often, you know, end with and depression. And I assume that the depression has a lot to do with the fact that they have other diagnoses that they're struggling with. Have you encountered people with multiple diagnoses, and is it more difficult to involve someone with a complex diagnosis in mindfulness therapy?
Well, it may be, but we treated many people who have complex diagnoses, and complex diagnoses are not unusual. We don't understand everything about the complexity of how these things relate, but we've treated people with multiple diagnostic issues, and I don't have time to get into how mindfulness can help them, but mindfulness is what we call a transdiagnostic approach, meaning it works for multiple diagnoses. For example, as we've talked about today, it works for anxiety issues as well as depression. And that may be true of different types of anxiety. People who have social anxiety, for example, it can work very well. And we find that even people with things like post-traumatic stress disorder, it can be helpful. So it can be useful for many diagnoses because it deals with the general factors. Like if you develop an observing self and you develop those skills, that can be helpful for multiple diagnoses, because as you learn to be able to recognize how you're thinking or reacting to situations, when you learn to be able to respond to them, it puts you in a much better position to deal with a variety of problems.
I want to circle back to something that you mentioned really at the start of our interview, which is the fact that when somebody is practicing mindfulness, you're actually able to see changes in their brains. Can you take us through the science of that and what you've studied?
Well, there are certain areas of the brain, like the amygdala, that sends out alarms and warnings. And what we find in depression, that may be very increased. So the person is very anxious, depressed, and on alert because of these constant warnings that are being emitted from the amygdala area. And then there are areas of the brain that help regulate emotions, such as the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and that helps tone down the amygdala. But in depression, that area is down-regulated, and antidepressants help bring that area up to speed, and so does mindfulness approaches help bring that area up to speed. And actually, a number of different approaches help boost that area of emotion regulation. Transcranial magnetic stimulation, another approach to treating depression, actually is aimed at bringing that area, stimulating the area of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So there's dysfunction in depression and in anxiety in different areas of the brain, and mindfulness is a useful technique that can empower an individual to help regulate their own emotions.
There's a really interesting one of the appendix sections of your book, an interesting diagram that shows the arrows of a depressed person. You know, that it's got a very small arrow for emotional regulation, and I would imagine that arrow gets a lot bigger as somebody undertakes mindfulness training.
Yes, that's exactly right. That area is boosted, and it has more activity once you help them develop their mindfulness skills.
We just have a few seconds left of the program today. Dr. Eisenrath, you know, if somebody right now listening to us is experiencing depression and this sounds like a really promising direction for them to take, how do they find a therapist who has been trained in this technique? Obviously, they can buy your book, but are there ways that people can seek out therapists who know how to use mindfulness?
Well, the best way to find a local person is actually just to Google mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and see who's available in your area. And there have been people who've trained throughout the country in it, and in some areas more so than less. But if you look at that, there are usually people in those areas. And the book, of course, helps give you an overview of the procedures involved as well.
Dr. Stuart Eisendrath, author of When Antidepressants Aren't Enough, Harnessing the Power of Mindfulness to Alleviate Depression. Thanks so much for being with us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Really appreciate your time.